Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic. And today I'm going to be talking to Tony Black, who is the author of numerous books. But today we're going to be talking books about Star Trek and about TV shows and myth. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But mainly we're going to be talking about his new book, which has recently come out, called The Cinematic Connery, which is absolutely touching my sweet spot. And I'm sure is touching a lot of your sweet spots as well. Or sweet spots, I should say, perhaps. That's the only one I'm gonna do. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, subscribe, and do all that stuff that you have to do to keep this podcast going. And but before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
I grew up in the 90s, so by that point he was a bit of a cinematic emeritus figure. You know, he was the big superstar, but he was doing various different things like The Rock or, you know, Entrapment and all of these big blockbuster movies that, you know, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade in the late 80s, stuff like that, that was huge. And he was one of those marquee names with, you know, you get over a poster. And I think I actually discovered him there before I discovered James Bond, you know, him as James Bond, really, anyway. And he became my favorite actor very quickly. And I've thought about why, and I talk a little bit about why in the book, in that I think it was that he represented a real sense of old world strength and masculinity in his performances that you didn't get everywhere else. And charisma, you know, I'm really drawn to very charismatic actors. I mean, I really like Tom Cruise as an actor. My wife hates him,
right?
You know, and he's quite Marmite, but he has a similar kind of thing to Connery in the sense of, you know, there is such a force about them and the way they do things and a singularity that makes them really appealing to watch, even if their movies aren't always great. So I think I just loved his films, or most of his films anyway, and I just really liked the way he performed. And I think it's just stuck with me all the way through, even though he stopped making films relatively when I was relatively young, you know? So I think that was it, really.
Yeah, it's funny that I'm trying to think of where my relationship with him started. Certainly, I mean, I was growing up in the 80s, so you know, Roger Moore was my cinematic Bond.
Yeah, same.
You know, Connery was the TV Bond. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a Connery Bond on the big screen. But I think I think the film that I really loved that he did was Outland. I think that was the film that I remember seeing, the science fiction Peter Higham film.
1981, that was.
Yeah. And you compare it to Alien in your book, which is which I think is a fair cop.
Yeah, I think they're very different films, obviously, but I think they could live in the same universe because they both represent this very cold capitalist future for humanity. And Connery's like an old, you know, it was based heavily on High Noon. High Noon was the big inspiration point for Outland. And Connery is very much that old classic Western character who he's going to fight the bad guys. Literally, the ending is him waiting for the bad guys to come and try and kill him, and him have to try and battle them. And it's that I love that. And I think that fits very well in that cold futuristic sci-fi lens. And I wish he'd made more films like that, to be honest. And that's the thing with him. He did so many different genres and so many different movies. You could never really pigeonhole him into one thing, despite Bond. But I'd love to have seen him do more of that kind of stuff, really, because Outland's very good. Very good film.
I think your book's really interesting from the point of view that, I mean, I think I know a lot about Sean Connery. I've read a biography. I remember going to Scotland once with my mum and dad when I was like a kid, when I was like 8 or 9, and I was reading this Sean Connery paperback biography, really sort of thin one, really not particularly, you know, something just culled from newspaper interviews and stuff.
Yeah.
And they were sort of like, we're on holiday, we're in Scotland. And I was like, yeah, but I'm reading about Sean Connery. So I'm kind of in the...
You're on brand there. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But your book, there was certain aspects of his life that I hadn't previously sort of appreciated. And one of them is the points you make that he kind of comes to Bond and he's already quite a good actor. He's already had a hell of a lot of experience.
Yeah, and he's been a jobbing actor for the better part of a decade, really, in terms of television. And he's done a lot of TV. He's done a lot of TV movies. There's one where there was a TV movie called Blood Money in the US. It was about a boxer, and it was written by Rod Serling, who went on to write The Twilight Zone, mid-50s. It's adapted for the UK, and Connery plays the boxer. This is late 50s. Sadly, it doesn't survive anymore because they used to wipe the tapes, you know, back in the day, which is good. I know it's gutting because like so much great stuff was lost, you know. But there's some audio that was found about 10 years ago that you can hear, and the stills and things like that. So he did a lot of that. He did some theatre, you know. He did like Anna Karenina on stage. He did Macbeth, you know, as well. And years later, he tried to get a Macbeth movie mounted. Which Connery's Macbeth on screen would have been marvelous, I think, or marvellous. Would have been brilliant.
You're only allowed one. You've had your one there.
Right, I've had my one. Okay. it's got to be done. But yeah, that's a shame. But he was also doing a lot of supporting roles. You know, he was playing the romantic, not necessarily the romantic lead, but the romantic character in stuff like Another Time, Another Place in the late 50s, and playing the comedy sidekick at points as well. So there's a film called On the Fiddle, which was not long before Dr. No, where I've said in other interviews and things, he's a bit like Bernard Breslau from The Carry-Ons. He's that big, hulking sort of, you know, hello, that kind of guy. And you just don't really associate him in some ways with the Connery you know. So his career could have gone down a very different path, I think, had Bond not come along.
I mean, one of those paths was the path to Manchester United, because he was sort of like almost scouted, you know, the great, you know, obviously he must have been quite a talented football player.
I think he was, yeah. I mean, you know, history could have gone a different way, and he might have ended up on the Munich airplane, you know, at that
which would have
been awful, obviously, you know, in the late 50s. But yeah, he did have football trials. I mean, he did loads of things before the movies came along and before entertainment came along, because he discovered He was in South Pacific on stage, and that's where he started to get breaks. But he was in the Navy for a spell. Didn't do very well in the Navy because he just doesn't get on with authority. He didn't get on with authority very well. And he did loads of jobs. He was a milkman. You know, he was, I think he did some paint and decorating. He was just all through like the 40s, late 40s into the early 50s. He was, because he was such a big guy and he could do a lot of trades. And I mean, his brother Neil ended up being a plasterer. And I don't think Neil quite had the physique he did in the same way, but he was, you know, a strong bloke. So I think they had that. They were from that classic Scottish working class stock, you know. And of course, he was Mr. Universe in the mid-50s. And there's pictures in the book of him extremely buff, like when he's like in his mid-20s. So yeah, he had a quite a varied, fascinating life even before he came to the movies.
Yeah, and you know, some of those roles that he's portraying. I remember seeing a crime movie. You mention it in the book. The title escapes me, but I'm sure.
Brighton City.
Yes, he plays a Scottish, a sort of Irish-sounding Scottish gangster. Criminal cat burglar type, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Herbert Lom is in it as well, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, he did a couple of with Herbert Lom. He did Hell Drivers. Well, he had a small supporting part in Hell Drivers, in a great movie that is, in the late 50s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which has the litany of people in that cast is incredible, even in supporting roles. You know, Patrick McGoohan and Herbert Lom and Stanley Baker, all these people. But yeah, The Frightened City, I've always thought, was kind of his version of Daniel Craig's layer cake in terms of an audition piece for Bond, unofficially. I don't think that was what got him the Bond part, don't get me wrong. But I do think I'd be surprised if Harry Saltzman and Cobby Broccoli hadn't watched The Frightened City as well and gone, oh, he's got something there. He's got some presence and danger, because that's, I think, the first movie that he really gets to show that on the screen.
And so then he gets the role of Bond. And I mean, the details around this have almost become as legendary as, Terence Young telling him to sort of sleep in a suit and them looking out of the window and watching him watching him walk down the street and thinking, wow, this guy doesn't give a shit, you know. How much do you think, because also you make the very good point, which is that Ian Fleming's Bond and Connery's Bond are really different sort of characters. So how much do you think that was down to Connery himself, just sort of what he brought to the table?
I think there was quite a bit of that, really, because I mean, Fleming historically didn't like the choice, you know, at first. He was very, very due. I think he thought Connery was a commoner who didn't deserve to play Bond, who in his mind, you know, this is well known, but he was like a Hoagy Carmichael figure. You know, he was very different, kind of much more posh and establishment. And, you know, Connery was not posh or establishment. You know, he tried throughout his life. You know, if you listen to him in interviews, it's very interesting how he often uses the term one. He says one would not, you know, debase himself like that. So I think there's a lot with Connery where he's trying to be a little bit more upwardly mobile and educated. And he was, actually. I mean, he read a lot, you know, he studied a lot. He was an intelligent man. But he wasn't establishment. So coming into Bond, I think he brought a lot of that natural... can I swear?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think he brought a lot of that natural, you know, fuck you energy to Bond. And even though he was refined and he had that class that he brought into the part, there was danger and there was a sense of, you know, a real brawler in there and and that gangster kind of figure in a way, you know, that he could rough you up. And I think that was Connery. And I think without that, Bond, yes, changes throughout the years and he morphs depending on the actor playing him. But every single Bond, even Roger Moore, had that element of Bond to them all the way through. There were Roger Moore films where he's really nasty, like The Man with the Golden Gun or For Your Eyes Only. And there are Connery touches, even with Roger Moore. And I think without Connery, I don't think Bond would have been as successful. I do not think it would still be around today in the way it is. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Burt Reynolds audition tape for Indiana Jones, you know. But there's a sort of alternative universe in which that could happen. And then you think, yeah, that would never have happened. There was no, you know, he was so wrong for that role.
Yeah.
And similarly with James Bond, you just think, yeah, Connery, it has to be him. For him to become this huge sort of phenomenon, for instance, if they'd started with Roger Moore, because they're roughly the same age, right? They're not.
There was about 3 years in it, I think. And Moore was well known. I think he might have been sort of on the table at the beginning. But he was tied up with the Saint and TV and things, so it would have never have happened. But I don't. So yeah, it would have. I don't know if Roger Moore would have been able to make it what it was at that point. Yeah, I agree.
And I mean, the interesting thing, I did a rewatch of the Bonds about a year, or maybe it was a couple of years ago, it was sort of the beginning of COVID. And the thing I noticed as I went through the lot, well, the first thing I noticed is how few of them actually work as films, you know, that once you get outside of the Connerys, especially after those first, say, three, I would guess, you know, you're quickly going, this isn't really a film. I mean, it's a Bond film, but it's not really a film, you know. But it's interesting to see how they sort of build up the character and how they build up those different aspects of him. And yet at the same time, he arrives in Dr. No and he's fully made, you know.
It's quite remarkable, really, because Dr. No wasn't a beat for beat, you know, version of that book. You know, it's definitely different from the book in some ways. And I think it is quite remarkable how it comes together in that sense. I think it's just a bit of an alchemy of actor, of writing, of the way that Terence Young shot it. You know, you mentioned Terence Young earlier. Many people said he could have been Bond in real life. Mm. He had the look, he had the tailoring, he had the breeding, he had the suaveness, yeah, you know, all that. And he, like you said, he took Connery to Savile Row and he got him dressed because he went to the audition that you touched on earlier, I think in like a t-shirt and jeans, you know. And he was very much, well, you take it or leave it. At first, I think he refused to screen test, you know. He was like, well, I'm not doing that, you know. And this is a guy who, he's not at the peak of his career by any means. You know, he's been in like The Longest Day in the same year, which he's got quite a big movie, but it's a tiny part, you know, it's a cameo. He's not really at the point that he can command anything, but he doesn't care. He's like, I am who I am. And if I don't want to do something, I'm not going to do it, whatever happens. And that, I think, is part of why this all came together. Because I think in some ways, in a weird way, I think he felt he had nothing to lose. And I think that actually informs how it all starts, really.
Yeah, and in The Longest Day, of course, he's playing, he's playing like an Irish guy, isn't he? Was he playing an Irish guy in The Frightened City as well?
Oh, do you know, he could have been.
I think he was. I think he's like a Paddy or something. I mean, it's literally...
Oh, yeah, he is. Paddy Damien is his name, I think, in that. Yeah, I think he was an Irish guy. Not that you'd know, to be fair.
No, of course not. I mean, heaven forbid. I did a video. I should, I'll link to it in the show notes, but I did a video, very amateurish video called Around the World with Sean Connery. And it just goes to all his different accents, which are exactly the same accent.
Yeah, do link that. That sounds funny.
I was just thinking when you were talking about the class aspect, which I think is really fascinating, because I remember the scene, I think it's in Goldfinger, where he sort of discusses the different brandy or the different wine with, and M is sitting next to him and he's like, you know, shut up, Bond, you know, it's like, stop showing off, you know. And it's just a really funny scene. And I think the humor of it is that actually these upper class people, with the exception of Terence Young perhaps, aren't really that necessarily that knowledgeable about all this stuff. I mean, Ian Fleming was famously a rotten cook and really had no taste whatsoever in terms of drink or what he would do is he would write to people who, you know, a famous food critic and say, okay, Bond's gonna have a meal, what should he have? And they would give him this information and he'd write it into the book because he wasn't a connoisseur at all. You know,
I didn't know that, actually. No, that's a good fact about Fleming. Yeah, I think it's a funny, it's weird how the Bond films are a strange combination of lots of different things. There is, as you say, that clash between the class system and the fact you have these people who aren't necessarily upper class themselves making it. But you've also got the Anglo-American aspect in that the two producers of the movies are both Americans. Cubby Broccoli could not be more Italian-American if he tried, you know. Yeah, and that whole lineage of that it comes from is not at all the British establishment and the upper class. And I think that's why it works. I think that's why it's so distinctive, because it is a real combination. You know, the glitz and the glamour, and you know, you see it particularly in Goldfinger, as you said, he's extremely American. You know, if you'd made this in a British style at this time, purely British style, it would have been really pompous. It would have been really stiff, I think. And he wouldn't have nearly had the sexiness and the swagger of that. You know, that I always think it's that Mad Men era of America, you know, where everyone is dressed really well. There's just a real confidence in that sort of boom era of America in the early 60s. And it bleeds into Bond, and it brews up with Connery's pure machismo, his sex appeal. You know, the fact that it triggers a movement almost equivalent to Beatlemania. Bond mania has been written about. You know, James Chapman, who's written brilliant books about Bond. You know, he talks about Bond mania at the time, and yeah, Connery was being mobbed like the Beatles were in the mid 60s. You know, I don't know if you saw Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho.
Yes, with a thunderball sort of.
Do you remember that? Yeah. The brilliant shot of the thunderball poster, you know, emblazoning a Soho cinema. And it's an amazing shot. You know, Thomasin McKenzie walks out and she sees this. And Connery's there, you know, on one knee with a big harpoon in his hand. And it's like, that's what it was like. You know, he was huge and it was everywhere. So I think that is a major reason why it took off, because it had all of these elements that weren't just about one upper class system being reinforced.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of a breakthrough. And of course, there's the escapism as well of, you know, I mean, the amount of travel and how we forget today in our years of Ryanair and EasyJet. but you watch a Bond movie and him just walking through an airport is enough to cue the John Barry music. It's like, look, he's in an airport, you know? So he's going to the moon or something.
Yeah. They ought to try that these days with people walking through Heathrow, you know, and loop some John Barry over it. Wouldn't have the same effect, would it?
No. Because we all go the crocodile cues and the...
But yeah, I think that exoticism definitely was a part of why this worked. You know, people were able to dream of going to the Bahamas or going to, you know, Venice and all of these amazing places. And, you know, I do think that's one thing that Bond has managed to keep and keep recapturing. I think even in the new movies, many of them, you know, I mean, in No Time to Die recently, there was that beautiful Matera in Italy, that city that's like a stepped city. I mean, it's gorgeous. And you think, oh man, to drive an Aston Martin around there would be incredible. And so it's kept that exoticism and glamour that was absolutely there at the beginning with Connery and his films.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the globe trotting and the sort of the postcard locales and everything. Yeah. And in between the Bond films, he's already sort of trying to, you know, I mean, it's almost from the very beginning he starts to sort of... you know, try to stretch himself, try to get out there, try to make it about, as you said in the book, it make sure that he's not losing Connery the actor to Bond the character. The one film that really stands out in that period is the Alfred Hitchcock Marnie, which is a very, very strange film.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite strange. I think it's because it's obviously a classic Hitchcock in the sense it's about a blonde who is, you know, in a difficult situation with very controlling men around, and there's an element of mystery. But it's a real, I mean, I think looking back on it now, there have been some really interesting takes about how controversial some of these subjects are, you know, in Marnie. And Connery is, you know, during this period, he makes a few films where he's playing off this Bond persona that he now has and trying to shake it off. You know, with Marnie, he's playing this quite toxic masculine man who's got Tippi Hedren, you know, in his headlights. In Woman of Straw, which is a much less well-made melodrama, really, in the same year by Basil Dearden, he plays the nephew of Ralph Richardson's, you know, wealthy British man, and he's caught in a web of seduction and intrigue with Gina Lollobrigida, who at that time was huge, you know. And he plays second fiddle to her, really, and it's a bit of a rubbish part, but he's very suave in that. He's well tailored. And then Irving Kirshner's A Fine Madness in about 1965-66. I think I really don't like this film, and Connery's performance in it He's fine, but he's playing an awful, awful man. Like he's a tormented writer who is so up his own backside, you know, to wonder he could see daylight. And it's billed as a farce or comedy, but it didn't work for me personally. But in all of these things, he's playing variations on the, in all of them, there are glamorous women. There are, you know, he's caught in a web of sex and all this kind of thing. But he's not Bond, and he's not trying to be Bond, but at the same time, he can't quite escape it. And it feels like all these other roles that he's being cast in outside of Bond are everyone who are making these films have one eye on the fact that Sean Connery is James Bond, and they can't quite lose that. And I think it drives him mad. I think it's partly one of the things that leads him to have such frustration and antipathy with Bond by the time you get to the mid to late 60s, because by then he's really had enough. And I think a lot of it is that he really wants to be, in his heart, I think Connery was a character actor. And I think I think stardom and that big screen charisma prevented him truly being that. But I think what he really wanted to be was a really respected, variable actor who did lots of different things. And I think he did that, but I don't think he ever quite got the acclaim. And the 60s, the start of the 60s, you really see him trying to make that break, I think.
Yeah, I mean, those films that you mentioned, I've not seen The Woman of Straw. I have seen Fine Madness, and obviously Marnie I've seen. Madness is a bin fire of a film. It's so weird.
It is.
Such a weird film. But yeah. It's similar with Marnie, where when I first watched Marnie, I didn't watch it thinking, oh, look at Sean Connery, he's playing a really toxic character. I saw it as, wow, they made the male hero go in a weird direction. You know, I saw it being he's the hero. And because this was the period where there was a fairly constant sort of trope of male leads sort of boasting of themselves being, you know, male chauvinist pig and proud of it. And where, you know, it's that sort of playboy generation where we're supposed to go, that's actually a quite, you know, nowadays it would be a Jordan Peterson position, you know.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, you know, that even then, I don't know if I was, and the same with a Fine Madness. You're supposed to think, I think you're supposed to like him. I don't think
you are.
Think, right,
yeah,
exactly,
you are.
Yeah.
And you don't.
No.
You really don't, but you're supposed to.
Oh, it's such a badly, poorly conceived film, yeah. From every angle. It's kind of like that, if he doesn't beat you, he doesn't love you sort of philosophy.
It's awful, yeah.
And this sort of keys into something else that you bring up, and because your book isn't biographical, you make that point very clear. This, you know, you trace his career rather than his life, rather than his marriages and his family and stuff like that. You give it, you know, you mention it, but you don't. And of course, one of the controversies you don't shy away from is that the infamous interview he gave with Playboy, where he talked about his attitude towards slapping women. How did you, I mean, that becomes, that also means that when you watch something like A Fine Madness, you're sort of thinking there's no distance between him and the character necessarily.
I know. And it is one of the things that that interview haunted him a little bit throughout his career. It came back up in the early 80s, I think, with an interview with Barbara Walters on TV. I think it came back up again in the 90s at some point, but I make a point at the end of the book of openly wondering how Connery would have done had he been maybe 10, 15 years younger and he was still around and he was maybe still making films. How would he have survived the Me Too era? And I'm not sure that he would, because I mean, even after he died, there were one or two really vitriolic pieces calling him out as a bully and an abusive husband, you know, because there were reports that he'd hit his wife, you know, Diane Colento back in the 60s and all this kind of thing. And I mean, that interview essentially spells out that his philosophy was, yeah, a woman needs a slap if she's not in line. Now, I wouldn't call myself a feminist, John, to be honest. I'm not going to be one of those guys who says that. But equally, I find that hard to square with the Connery that I do like as a performer, you know, those aspects are repellent to me. You know, I do think that, but I think I really do think in these kind of instances, and I'm not defending him, but I think we have to put it in the context of the era. And I think we have to think at that time, those comments would maybe have been a bit controversial, but they wouldn't have been considered like they are today. And where I think we do cast people in one particular light based on what they say, when human beings are quite complex. And I think, I don't think he should be defended for that, but I do think that maybe historically there was more of an understanding, and I think this may be something we've lost today, in that comments exist within the time period they're made in. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why his career was never destroyed by this and never tarnished by it in the way I think it would be today. And I think in some ways, I wonder if it was part of him saying that was part of him building up this masculine persona that he was very well known for in the movies. You know, I don't necessarily think it was calculated and he did it on purpose to help his career, but I do think there was an image of Bond that, and there was the audiences found a real difficulty in delineating Connery and Bond. You know, he would have people shout at him, Mr. Bond, on the street, and it drove him mad because he's like, I'm Sean Connery. And I think maybe there was that element of, you know, he does an interview for a magazine like Playboy, and there is maybe a readership that expects certain things. I think it's complex, and I think it's a really difficult one, that whole interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I mean, in the end, I go with what my dad used to say, where, you know, I like football, I don't particularly like footballers. And I find it very easy to you know, to watch actors who I disagree with and who maybe have done things that I really don't like. I think it is important to have an eye on the context. And I think you're right, the Playboy magazine. And I think to some extent, even the Barbara Walters interview, he's kind of gets his back up a bit because it's like, you know, how dare you talk to me like that? You know, God damn it, I've done it again.
You've done two. You broke your own rule there, John.
Okay, I'll tell you what, let's just do the rest of the the podcast in Sean Connery voices.
That works for me. Yeah.
you're too good. You're too good.
How long could we sustain it? That's the question.
Who could know? I'm not sure.
Yeah, about 10 seconds. Yeah,
exactly. I'm spent. I think it is a complicated thing. I don't see any need to, like, for instance, one of my guests from a few weeks back, Hannah Flint, mentioned the fact that she tweeted when Sean Connery died, RIP Sean Connery, he was one of my favorite actors, with some problematic, you know, views about women. And she was like, I got so much vitriol for that. And I think it's wrong. I think you don't deserve to get that. I think it's right to say, I don't, it's not about destroying careers or canceling people or anything like that, because I don't really think that actually happens anyway. It's more about, it's just about looking at people in the context of their times, but also, you know, saying what you don't like. Anyway, let's move on from that. It's what you say though about it being a part of that masculine persona, and he's to some degree perhaps playing up to it. I think that's interesting. I think that's that's definitely something that I suspect is true, that that's his sort of. Did you used to see him on A Round with Alice? That was one of my abiding memories of Sean Connery. He used to appear quite often. I'm sure you can find them on YouTube. This was if people don't know, this was a BBC show where celebrities would play golf with Peter Alice, I think.
Okay.
And he would do this quite a lot. And the thing that was funny was obviously the whole point was where they're conducting a bit of an interview as they're playing golf. And the hilarious thing was he was always so concentrated on the golf. He was like, shut up about that. I'm playing up. I've got to make this one for a birdie.
Well, golf, I think he loved golf more than anything. Like, yeah. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. Golf was his number one thing, you know. So for he would when he went on that show, I'm sure it was like, well, I'm going to play golf. You can ask me things, but like, that's not the point of this exercise. Yeah, the point exactly. is to play golf.
Exactly. I used to really love watching them. And it's also,
I need to find those.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they're on. And it also is the origin of one of my favorite Sean Connery stories, where I think Joe Cornish said this on the Adam and Joe show, but it's a story about a guy going caddying for him just during a normal game. He's just going around and he's caddying him, and after, like, a charity game or something, and after they start getting on with each other quite well, and so he sort of builds up his confidence, and so he says to Connery at one point, oh, you know, my dad does a really good impersonation of you. And Connery just turned to him and says, your dad sounds like an asshole.
That doesn't surprise me either. Yeah.
So coming away from Bond, if Terence Young was the director who sort of created the Bond Connery, or collaborated with him to create the Bond Connery, then would it be fair to say that sort of Sidney Lumet is the director who sort of helps him forge a career outside of Bond with his, you know, with some startling films?
I think there is an argument for that. I mean, he collaborates with Sidney Lumet four or five times over the space of 25 years, nearly.
Right.
The majority of the films they do are in the 70s. They do The Hill in 1965. They do The Anderson Tapes in 1971. They do The Offence in 1973. And then Murder on the Orient Express in 1974. And then Family Business in 1989. So there's a bit of a gap there.
Right.
So it wasn't necessarily I wouldn't necessarily say it was a De Niro Scorsese kind of thing in quite that way. But I do think that, you know, he never collaborated with people more than once on many occasions. I think the only other director outside of the Bond films anyway, that he did more than one film with was Richard Lester. Because he did Robert and Marion and Cuba with Richard Lester.
Mm.
Now, Peter Hyams as well. He did two with Peter Hyams. Outland and Presidio.
Presidio, yes. Yeah.
But he very rarely would do. There might be one or two examples as well where he did maybe two films, but that was it. Sidney Lumet, he did many more with. And I think they had a shorthand in a relationship that I think Lumet considered Connery the greatest actor of that era, I think, or one of them. And I think he just, and every film they made was different. It wasn't that they just rinsed and repeated.
Mm.
But what he did in each of those films was that he found different registers for Connery to play in. And particularly, I'd say, in The Hill and The Offence, which are the two best of their collaborations. Because Murder on the Orient Express, Connery's part of an ensemble. You know, that's more Albert Finney's film, really, than anything else. And in Family Business, he also has Dustin Hoffman in there, Matthew Broderick. So he's part of a three-hander. And The Anderson Tapes is the one that isn't that good, really, but I don't think. But The Hill and The Offence, he strips back all of what we know Connery to be, essentially. He makes him a harder, far less charismatic, often, especially in The Offence, a deeply problematic individual. The Offence, I think, is his best role.
Mm.
And in terms of acting, his best film. Not necessarily the best film he was in, but it's his best movie as a performer, because he has to go to a place he's never been before. And honestly, he never goes again in his career in terms of playing this detective who he goes up against a horrific murderer and starts to see in himself traits that are repulsive and disturbing. And he sort of loses his mind throughout doing it. And it's such a great, powerful piece based on a play by John Hopkins. And I think, and The Hill, obviously, The Hill really is an inspiration for things like Stanley Kubrick and Full Metal Jacket, you know, Platoon, those kind of war films that really get under the fingernails of how traumatizing war can be on soldiers, on individuals. And I think what Lumet saw in Connery was that, yes, he has charisma, yes, he has that presence, but he could also go to places that people don't associate Connery to go to. And he really gets there in a lot of these films. And I think Connery really appreciated the fact that Lumet was willing to invest in him in that way. You know, and he tried, like I say, he tried it with lots of other directors throughout his career. But I think so many of them ended up going back in some ways to the well of Bond, whereas Lumet didn't do that always. Lumet always tried to find what else Connery could do. And I think that's why he kept going back to him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what Lumet manages to do with him is sort of taps in to that anger that that is there even with Bond. You know, there's a bit in James Bond movies where Connery sort of narrows his eyes and you think, good God, you know, you really believe he could kill people. There's no, Roger Moore, it's kind of like when he kills people, it's a bit like, what? Really? You killed that guy? with Connery, it's like, oh, I could imagine his face as he strangled me, you know. He'd strangle me with his bare hands.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind. No, I'm joking. Because
I'd welcome it.
I think the Anderson tapes, I would actually go out to bat a little bit for the Anderson tapes. It just has, it's a good, for me, it's a great heist film. It doesn't quite decide how it wants, heist is usually a film that's sort of like usually pitched as a comedy, and this isn't really that. But it doesn't really go, it doesn't have any real dramatic heft either. But I think it really works as a sort of just a technically good, you know, and it's got a young Christopher Walken in his first screen role, as
that's
you point out in the book.
That's true.
And, you know, Connery coming out of the prison at the beginning, it's just like, wow, it just has that 70s great feel to it. I feel.
Yeah, that's true. It very much does. Yeah, yeah. No, maybe I'm being a bit unfair. I mean, what Anderson Tapes definitely was a bit ahead of its time in terms of some of the ideas about surveillance. You know, it's a bit of a precursor to The Conversation.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
From Coppola a few years later, which I think does a lot of the same stuff better in many ways. But yeah, maybe I'm being a bit unfair. But yeah, I think Family Business isn't super successful, but I think every film he makes with Lumet is interesting. If some of them are great and the rest are interesting. And I don't think any director quite got out of him what he did. But it was interesting how all the different directors he does work with more than once did try and do different things, you know. And I think... But I do wonder why he didn't go back to more people. I think maybe there were points where he just didn't get on with them. You know, I think he worked on a movie and he's like, I'm not working with him again.
Yeah.
I don't think he was ever directed by a woman either. I think it was always men, which is understandable in the sense that, you know, very few female directors were working really throughout those decades. But certainly not in the kind of films Connery was making.
No,
but,
yeah, I mean, in the 70s, there was like Elaine May was basically...
Elaine May.
You know, there's Ida Lupino in the 50s and Elaine May in the 70s. And I think there weren't very many at all.
Catherine Bigelow in the 80s, I guess. But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, but there were very few. So he wouldn't have had those opportunities. But it would have been fascinating to see what would have happened if he had been directed by a woman, I think. I think John Huston... I think gets a great performance out of him in The Man Who Would Be King. I think again, but which is a blend of Bond and the other kind of things he was doing. So, yeah.
I think that the man who would be king, one of the surprise whenever I rewatch that is how funny he is, and how I mean, obviously he works brilliantly with Kane, but you know, tell him my gorge is rising. It's just so funny, and it's so about masculinity again with that, and a sort of homoeroticism. You know, he ends up sort of dressing up as Alexander the Great, and you know, I mean, like, just that fact where they offer him a woman or a boy and he gets disgusted by it. But it's just like, man, you're spending all your time with Michael Caine. You know what I mean? That's your...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's a real shame. Well, there's two things out of that that's a shame. It's a shame he didn't do more with Caine, because obviously they were great mates throughout their whole life. And, I mean, have you ever seen the clip? I think it's at the 1989 Oscars, where he, Caine, and Roger Moore present an award, and the banter between them on stage is glorious. It's just so nice to they're just clearly three mates, and I do think that it's that chemistry in The Man Who Will Be King is brilliant between those two. It's just a shame they didn't do more. But I also think it's a real shame that Connery didn't get to do more comedy, because he didn't do that a lot. But whenever he did sneak it in to his movies, he was so good. I mean, particularly the one that stands out, I think, for a lot of people is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, because he's so funny in that film. And he does transform from this quirky little bookish, massively different character that you would ever expect Connery to play, to by the end, he's on a horse and he's Connery again, basically. Yeah. And he's like, right, let's go. You know, and he does do that transformation, but he's so funny. And I just would love and then in The Rock, then one-liners that he brings in, Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet from Porridge, and a lot of great, but he brings them in for so many films to just write him these brilliant one-liners. He even in Never Say Never Again gets them to put in the joke about, can you fill this beaker? Or what, from here? From Porridge, which is he gets them to recycle that for Never Say Never Again from Porridge. And he nails it. Maybe not quite as well as Ronnie Barker did, but he nails it, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I wish he'd been able to do genuinely just stick him in a comedy and let him rip, because I think he would have been brilliant.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, sorry to hark back to Bond, but that's what I think. His Bonds are so much funnier than Roger Moore's. Roger Moore's Bonds are silly, and that's not the same thing as funny. You know, Roger Moore's Bonds rely on sort of John Glenn dropping stupid music cues. Or
a pigeon doing a double take.
Absolutely. Some guy looking at a bottle of wine and back at the hovercraft. They're just shit. I mean, that's what I think about Daniel Craig coming in Casino Royale. They're actually, he gets unfairly sort of painted with this idea that his films are humorless. He's so much wittier and funnier and much more genuinely fun. You know, do I look like I give a damn? Is a much funnier line than anything you would have in, you know. But as you say, I mean, Indiana Jones, I should have mailed it to the Marx Brothers.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
What a line.
It's so good. She talks in her sleep, which he improvised. The whole scene where he finds out, he's there, how do you know she was a Nazi? He improvised that line and they all just cried with laughter on the set, and Spielberg went, that's staying, that's brilliant. So they, you know, and that's it. He was naturally funny. I think quite often he would improvise whenever he could, and he'd bring that humor in. Again, that the great thing about that is that he's playing on the masculinity. He's playing on that Connery, what people think of him, you know, because in really they could originally Gregory Peck was going to be Henry Jones Senior, which I'd understand that in many ways. Excuse me. I totally get that. I could see that working in a different way. But no way, I think, could you have pulled that line off, and the idea that actually he sleeps with the beautiful blonde who's half his age and Indy's freaked out by it. Because you're doing it because Indy's dad is James Bond. Like, and you know what I mean? And it's that, and Connery understands that. And that's why he knows he can get away with it. And it's so good.
That's so sick. That scene is so sick. When he's saying, when he's, from in both senses of the word, sick. And the, when he says, you know, I've got as much right as the next man, I was the next man.
Exactly. But when it could have come across as really sort of skeevy, it actually doesn't. It's very funny and it's quite charming in its own way. And And very few actors could have pulled that off, which is again why I think he would have been able to sell actual comedy and being in a movie like that, which he never really does. I don't think he's brave enough. I don't think he thinks he can do it.
Right.
And he's never really in a film that goes fully into that comic persona, which is a shame.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not broadly comic, but I think he's always got, there's always wit to his character. And I think one of the films where he shows that very, very well, and again, maybe a little bit underrated, The Russia House of John Le Carré.
Yeah.
His character there, Barley Blair, is just so, you know, he's got that scene with like Ken Russell, I think, has a cameo in it. And there's sort of chat.
Ken Russell's in quite a bit of it, to be fair. Yeah, Ken Russell's got more to do than I thought he would in that film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they're kind of funny together. There's a real, I really like him in that film. I think he's really good. And I think he pulls off the sort of May to September romance with Michelle Pfeiffer very well. I mean, and also, you know, it's Michelle Pfeiffer and Sean Connery. They're two movie stars. So why wouldn't they, you know?
Absolutely. I think 10 years later, he's finding that harder to do with Catherine Zeta-Jones, really. I think then it's a bit of a stretch. But yeah, in the early 90s, when he, you know, he still didn't really look his age quite to the same extent. Absolutely. Yeah, he makes it work.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked. Talking about age, I was shocked when you said, you know, Diamonds Are Forever, he was 40. And I was like, Jesus Christ, he looks like he's 50 in Diamonds Are Forever. He looks awful.
It's weird because he actually looks way better 10 years later when he makes Never Say Never Again. He looks so much more youthful and you know, I those weren't his greatest years in terms of how he looked. Yeah,
of course, that's my I have seen a Connery Bond at the cinema. There you go, Never Say Never Again. I saw that.
You saw that? Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. So, I remember liking it, but then again, I was a kid, so what did I know? I was at that age where anything that was on the cinema was good. I remember, I think the first film, which was also stars Sean Connery, that I sat in, and I must have been like 16, 17, and I was watching it, and I just suddenly went, is this bad? Can that happen? Can they actually release a bad film? And it was Highlander 2.
Oh my God. The answer is yes, John. Do you know what, right? The thing is, actually, and I do hate to say this, but he made a lot of bad movies. Like, he really did. Outside of the Bonds, he did. Like, if you go through his whole career, as I have done, then there are a lot of films that people don't really remember for good reason. Things like Ransom, which was a film in the mid 70s where he plays a hostage negotiator. And it's rubbish. There's a film called The Next Man in the mid 70s as well, aka The Arab Conspiracy, which is like a geopolitical thriller. Not very good. You know, there's loads of examples of this throughout his career. And Highlander 2, The Quickening, which, I mean, to be fair, he was barely in it. And I think he said, like, pay me $1 million and I'll do 20 minutes work. And then I'm going. And he did. But, you know, I think he... He didn't always have the greatest choices, I think. Mm. I think he was always compelling. I think I don't think there were many films where he's not compelling to watch. But a lot of the ultimate final package of a lot of these films, they're not great movies. And it's really interesting to see that. And it's surprising, actually, because you'd assume he'd have this amazing body of work. And he doesn't. He has these fantastic movies at points. He has these iconic roles. But he has a lot of experimental stuff or things that are much more under the radar that just fundamentally don't work. Mm. And I think he always went into these things or came out of them as well thinking, I tried it. But audiences so often would reject it. I mean, he makes a one in 1982, which is a really weird year for Sean Connery. He makes two movies that are so off the track now. 5 Days, One Summer, where he's in the Alps with his brother's daughter, I think, and it's a bit of an incestual love affair, and it's just really, really strange. Fred Zinnemann's last movie, or Wrong is Right, aka The Man with the Deadly Lens, which is, it's a bit ahead of its time. Richard Brooks' film, a bit of a war satire, you know, about the Middle East, where he plays an American cameraman, news reporter, but he's miscast, you know? Mm. And so there were lots of these things that he did that when you watch them, they just don't hold together, sadly.
Where do you put Zardoz in that sort of spectrum?
Zardoz is in its own universe, John.
Right. Far in the future.
But yeah, far in the future. I think Zardoz is how do you describe Zardoz? I mean, it's the ultimate Connery experimentation, you know. Mm. The irony is that there's so many examples of how he turned down roles because he didn't understand them. He went, oh, I'm not playing Gandalf. I don't understand the script. Morpheus or the architect in The Matrix? No, I don't understand the script. Yet he makes Zardoz with John Borman. And, I mean, I think what he was drawn to were the ideas that Borman has in that film, really. Mm. But the ultimate expression of it is a curate's egg, I think it's fair to say Zardoz. You know, mm-hmm. it's infamous more now for the image of him in a big red nappy and a big sash holding a big gun with a big mustache. I think
the joke there is that that's the infamous image, but he's also in a wedding dress in that film as well. So the fact that there's an even more crazy image of him that just goes unnoticed is kind of funny as well.
I think there was an eccentricity about him in a way that didn't always come through. I mean, much, much later, and it's obviously much more of a corporate movie, but he makes The Avengers, the remake, which is, you know, pilloried by many people for good reason. But he's playing like a Bond villain, essentially, but he dresses at one point in a bear costume and he's having like a conversation with lots of scientists who he's, you know, it's that classic Bond scene that you get a bunch of scientists around the room and he says, this is my evil plan. And then anyone object? And then one guy goes, I object. And then he kills him, basically. It's that scene. But they're all dressed as a bear, basically. So like, it's really, really odd. And I think at times, I just think he liked to do these really eccentric, you know, moments and just play with that, really. Just to say, and I think Borman's a great filmmaker, and Zardoz is extremely strange and eccentric. And he didn't really understand science fiction, to be fair, Connery. He admitted that. He said he never really got sci-fi. But I think he liked the idea of something like Zardoz, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I've got a lot of affection for that film just because it's so freaking crazy. It's just like, you quote him in your book saying sort of like, I read the script twice and I was right. I was in immediately, you know. And it was like, was the script the same as the film? Because I can't see that on paper being, I guess you don't have the costumes in front of you, but this is a guy who is famous for being absolutely, you know, a bit of a pain in the ass on set and everything. And the morning they presented him with that costume, it's like, yes, that's fine.
Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah. I have no notes.
Can I keep my moustache?
I do think he just wanted to experiment. I do. Mm. I think he wanted people to see him in different guises, you know? And I think that's why. And I think there were certain filmmakers maybe he wanted to work with, you know. I think Borman was probably one of them, you know. And it's a shame he never got to do Excalibur later on because he was down for Borman's Excalibur and he couldn't do it. But he then later plays Arthur in the much less interesting First Knight in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
But playing Arthur in Excalibur would have been great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. First Knight is a weird one. It doesn't. Mm. I watched it quite recently, and does not stand up at all. No. Also, it was sort of the years when Richard Gere was sort of thrashing about trying to find what he wanted to do. You know. I mean, I think there is that thing that I got from reading your book, and this was one of the things that sort of surprised me. I started to think he's kind of like a closet intellectual. You know, at one point he says, you know, his favorite filmmaker is Ingmar Bergman, and Cries and Whispers. I went to see Cries and Whispers and I was transfixed. I couldn't, you know, I the 2 hours went and I was totally absorbed and I thought about this film loads. And I would, if I was, you know, if you put a gun to my head and say Sean Connery's favorite filmmaker and favorite film, I would not say Cries and Whispers in a million years. And you have the same thing. He's preparing to do Name of the Rose, the Umberto Eco adaptation.
Yeah.
And he reads Aristotle and he reads his, you know, he's going into stuff and he's trying to,
You know, I just get that feeling of, again, going back to Bond and his brandy, you know, he's actually had to make the effort to acquire this taste, to acquire these interests. And in some ways, that means that they're more deeply held and more knowledgeable than maybe people who've just been born into that world, you know. If you're, if you're, you'll always be that milkman from Edinburgh in your head. So, you know, you, when you're reading Aristotle, you're still reading it thinking, I used to deliver milk in Edinburgh. Now, now look at me, you know.
Now look at me. Yeah, no, yeah, I think you're right. I think he really aspired to more. I think he really did. You know, he did study, he did learn. He was quite, I think in some ways, he was quite an introvert in a way. I think he didn't want the limelight. I think he liked, he did like to be left alone. I think he did enjoy reading. I think he was... The persona that he had, to be fair, on screen and off screen, you know, I don't think there was too much of a difference. But I think the only difference was he did aspire for that intellectualism. And, you know, when you hear him talk, he is quite thoughtful about how he speaks. He doesn't just throw things out there. You know, he's the way he pronunciates words, you know, in interviews, the way he will respond to something. He'll use comments and phrases. You know, like at one point he says about Bond and how he doesn't want to be Bond forever. He says, I don't intend to go through a metamorphosis like that. And these kind of things where he could phrase things in a much more prosaic, you know, laid back way. And he doesn't. And I think people forget that about Connery, and that he was educated. He was quite well read. He did study acting as well. He studied with an acting coach called Jaap Malmgren in the, I think the 50s or the 60s. And he went... And he really did invest in that craft, you know, in a way that people don't appreciate. And I think that's partly why he was able to bring a physicality and a visual sense of performance, as well as his, you know, he was quite open about the fact that his accent and his voice was never going to change, and that he wasn't suddenly going to be doing a deep south drawl, you know, or this kind of thing, because he knows he couldn't do it. And he's been quite open about that. But I think the other elements of his performance, the way he moved, the way he held himself, I think he did study that, and I think he did think about that and consider that, and I think that's one of the reasons he's so magnetic on screen in many of his performances.
I think that thing about his accent and his voice, I mean, we were joking about it earlier, and he, you know, you quote him talking about the musicality of his voice and how he thinks about it musically, and how, you know, he goes over the scripts with the directors and the writers, and he sort of pays close attention to that sound. And when it comes to his accent, it's like, oh, well, if they're worrying about that, they're not interested in the character, so I don't care, you know. I think that really makes sense. You know, I mean, I really love Richard Burton, another great actor who's made a pile of, you know, questionable films, and he's he appears in films like The Klansman, sort of approximating some sort of, as you say, southern drawl. And yet it's still always Richard Burton, and he would be, technically you would regard Richard Burton maybe as a much more accomplished actor, but I see Burton and Connery actually in quite a similar sort of way. I'm always watching a Burton movie. I'm never like, you know, I'm never watching. He never disappears into the character for me.
Do you know another actor who I think forms a bit of a triumvirate in terms of actually the England, oh well, the UK, I should say, in that way? Richard Harris. Because I think if you look at the three of them, there are similarities in the sense that they all have very magnetic personalities. There are aspects of who they are in real life that bleed into the performances. Burton famously was considered for Bond, for Dr. No. And it didn't happen. I think probably the right choice, ultimately. But if you look at Burton especially, but Harris too, they never quite had that star power that Connery did at his height. Because they both burned out too fast. Yes, Harris lived longer than Burton, granted, but he wasn't super old. And in the end, the years of excess and partying and drinking and the hard lives that they lived, the tempestuous lives that those two lived, their stars shone hugely brightly. You know, they had their peaks in terms of careers. They were really respected. They gave these really fascinating performances. But in the end, they couldn't sustain it, really. Whereas Connery lived to a ripe old age. Yes, he retired about 20 years before he died. But I think had he chosen not to, I think he would have been making films for years after, and I think his star power would have continued. And I think that the difference was that Connery actually did lead a relatively conservative life in terms of drugs, alcohol, that kind of thing. I don't think he really did much of that. He had affairs, you know, he had, you know, there was a sexual aspect to his life, I think, and that kind of thing. But I think he didn't quite have that flame out sensibility. You know, he was married to his first wife, you know, for a shorter time, but his second wife he was married to for like 40 odd years, you know. And I think he had a stability that I think Burton and Harris never had. And I think that's the difference, in that maybe he didn't quite have the acclaim in terms of the acting, like certainly that Burton had, like you say, the stage acting and this kind of thing. And I think that's where Connery was always disappointed. I think that's why when he won the Oscar for The Untouchables, I think that meant a lot to him, because I think that was a real validation for his performance. And I mean, that was really justified for me. I think he's brilliant in that film. That's one of his best performances. But I think that side of it maybe eluded him a little. But I just find it interesting that there are certain actors in that era working at the same time. I mean, he makes the Molly Maguires with Richard Harris, which isn't a good film, but they're great on screen together. Again,
I disagree. You know, I love the Molly Maguire. Well, I don't love
it. Do you?
It,
do you like?
I think it's a really powerful film. I think it's very bleak. It's very dark.
And maybe that's what it is for me.
Yeah, it's very dark and bleak, I mean, it's just one of those subjects that you don't get much. I mean, you compare it in your book. You compare it to Shalako in terms of just not as a film, because it's a totally different film, but in terms of the historical period that it's going in. But it just strikes me, you know, other than John Sayles Matawan, we don't get films about unions and strikes, and they've got
a
usually violent and important history in the United States. And the Molly Maguires, I think, is a really, and I just love the idea of betrayal and friendship in that is so. I think that I would put that as a sort of one of those films that deep in his filmography that deserves to be taken out and brushed off and looked at. And again, it's him playing a real character of complexity rather than, which as we've learned from this conversation, he's kind of does more often than not, really, even if the film doesn't necessarily stand up to it.
Yeah. And he's good in that. Absolutely. But, and you know, there are certain actors like Harris that I wish he'd worked with more. I'd love to have seen him with Burton on screen. That would have been amazing.
He should have been in The Wild Geese, shouldn't he? If he'd been in Wild Geese, if he'd been the Sergeant Major in The Wild Geese.
Yeah. That would be great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Moore, absolutely. Connery, Harris, Burton. Oh, get Kane in there as well.
Yeah, all of them. Get the five. Wow. Yeah. That's a film. Oh, yeah. I mean, he was in an ensemble, wasn't he? He was in A Bridge Too Far, and he has a relatively sized part in that. But again, that wasn't the same. You know, he needs to be in one of these classic old war films with the big actors in that way. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, I've just mentioned the Molly Maguires as a film that is there a film you'd like to recommend that you think people haven't quite seen enough of with Connery?
I would probably. I mean, to be honest, I've kind of mentioned it already, but I think The Offence is one that I think people must try and seek out for the reasons I've said. To be honest, the other one that I think is not as well known anymore, and I think is a lovely film with a truly beautiful score by John Barry, is Robin and Marion. Because Robin and Marion...
Richard Lester film, right.
Richard Lester film, 1976. And, you know, Connery's quite well known for his cameo at the end of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where he swaggers on as King Richard and steals the film at the very end. But he played Robin Hood, you know, years before that, but he plays a middle-aged Robin Hood. And the beautiful thing about Robin and Marion is that him and Marion have been apart for years. Marion's had this horrible, loveless marriage to the Sheriff of Nottingham, and he comes back from the Crusades, similar to Prince of Thieves, but he's obviously Kevin Costner's younger in that film. But he comes back and he rekindles that love with Marion. But he's older, he's more measured, he has that real Connery charm on screen, but it has that element of that he knows his youth is behind him. And it's one of the first, for me, it's one of the first films where he's playing that Connery persona in real middle age. And I love that for it. You know, he's got not much hair on top, he's got a grey beard. You know, he's funny, he's charming, and it's not a brilliant film, don't get me wrong, you know, but it's It is lovely. And he's opposite Audrey Hepburn, who's a great middle-aged Marian. Right, Shaw is the Sheriff of Nottingham. It's a really good cast. You know, Ian Holm's in there, King John. I would recommend that. I definitely would. I think there's a lot to enjoy. And as I say, John Barry's best contains something. So, yeah, that's the one. There's a real palate cleanser that could be if you watch The Offence first, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, no, and we haven't even mentioned Highlander, which... you make the point, I think it's a good one, that he's sort of entering into his sort of mentor stage of his career, where he will be the older guy who tells the younger guy the lay of the land, you know.
Yeah, and he just does that for years then. He just rinses and repeats that for up until basically he retires in 2003 with The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He's basically playing... in almost every film, the same kind of role, the mentor in various different guises, which is fine. I think the last great performance, in fact, another one I'd recommend is Finding Forrester in 2000 by Gus Van Sant. I think he's brilliant in that. And it's a shame that wasn't his last performance, because I think on so many levels, it would have been a perfect final role for Connery, in that he plays a Scot, a reclusive, grumpy Scot who rediscovers his zest for life through... relationship with a young black writer in New York, and I think it's a gorgeous film, and I think he's so good in that, and he's playing himself in no small degree. So yeah, that is another one I think people should watch for sure.
Excellent. Listen, Tony, you mentioned earlier before we started recording that you'd written another couple of books. So I just want to briefly let's go through those. You've written A Cultural History of Star Trek.
Yes, Star Trek History and Us, which is all about the history of Star Trek when it comes on in the mid 60s, and it tracks it through all of the social cultural changes that Star Trek sort of reflects. So it's things like how the original series in the 60s affects the Vietnam War, about how it discusses that within the show and the anxiety about that, civil rights as well, obviously, with the Nichelle Nichols character in there and the first interracial kiss in the show and things like this. And then goes through how, you know, the later series and movies in the 80s reflect the Cold War and, you know, the change in relationship with Russia. And then how later on during the 90s, it sort of goes into how society is changing. You see in Star Trek in these later series how they start to reflect the cultural anxieties of the modern age in the 90s and the noughties about terrorism. And, you know, it's not just politics. It's a real mix of things, but it sort of brings it up to roughly about 2020, which is when I wrote the book. But I think it's a really interesting story, because it's not to say that Star Trek influences all of the 20th century, but it certainly reflects a lot of what's going on in a really interesting way, I think.
And you also wrote one about there's a myth making in Lost and other TV shows and other, you know, what's that about?
So this is called Myth Building in Modern Media, and it's more of a book about the mythologies within TV shows. So The X-Files was the first show to coin something called the myth arc, which is where you create within a universe, within a story, a sense of an in-universe mythology of, you know, a backstory as well about a broader world going on behind the scenes and how that influences the stories that are being told. And in that book, there's a lot of weaving in Joseph Campbell's sense of the monomyth as well, which is all about how archetypal characters and stories weave into the way mythologies are made. And I try and make the point that I think these modern TV shows and certain movie franchises, well, like Marvel, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, have actually created what I'd call the monomyth arc, which is all about bringing all of these archetypes, like the hero's journey and the saving the princess from the evil father figure and all of these kind of things that Joseph Campbell writes about in his brilliant book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, how they influence a lot of the modern TV shows and movies franchises that we see today. So it's a hard one to describe.
right.
I think it's interesting, because I think it maybe gives a little bit of a different perspective on some of these more popular shows that we've probably all watched.
Brilliant. Those sound really interesting. Maybe you can come on and talk about them at some point in the future when I've had an opportunity to go and read them.
I'd love to. Also, in terms of the Star Trek one, I'd love to, yeah. But in terms of the Star Trek one, I'm doing one about the unmade movies as well. That's my next book about all of the films and TV shows that were never made, like the Philip Kaufman story where they go back to ancient Greece and help them, or ancient Neanderthals, and help them make fire. And things like that. There's some wacky, wacky things and some fascinating projects. So yeah, that's my next one. And that'll be a fun trawl through a secret history of that franchise.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. What have you got a film book you'd like to recommend?
Well, I'd like to stick maybe to the Bond theme of sure. this, given its Connery. And I'd recommend a book that I found very useful in my production of the cinematic Connery, which was a book called Some Kind of Hero, which is the James Bond films by Matthew Field and AJ Chowdhury. And it's a really great history, essentially, of how those films were made. And it encompasses all the Connery films. And it goes up to, I think, maybe Spectre. I think it does, of the modern edition. I'm sure there'll be a new one about No Time to Die coming soon as well, a new edition. But it's brilliant. It's one of the best books for the history of that franchise ever, and it was hugely helpful to me. So yeah, if you haven't read that, if you're a fan of Bond and Connery, it's really great.
Excellent. Well, by the way, just as an additional thing, what did you think of Bond dying in No Time to Die? Where did you land on that, the horns of that dilemma?
I thought it was very good, actually, and I understand why people didn't take to that, but I think there's been a real difficulty in people's heads with the idea of Bond dying in that story and Bond dying as a character. Bond is not dead as a character. That is one iteration of Bond that died as part of the arc of Daniel Craig and his story. And to be honest, I think it's given the tone and the style of those five movies and how they awkwardly try and create a sense of continuity between the five, which sort of works, sort of doesn't. And it's a bit retroactive. But in terms of the theme and the arc of his character, I think him dying works very well. And I think we have to separate Daniel Craig's Bond from the idea of Bond. Bond will never die. Bond will always come back. And I think there's going to be no difficulty in my mind when in 2-3 years, Henry Cavill's Bond or whoever has the role pops back up. He's alive and well, and he's doing his thing. So I think it was really interesting. And I'm glad, because it means that they're not afraid now to properly end a story. And I think Daniel Craig's films were good enough that they deserved a really satisfying conclusion to his arc. So yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, me too. I totally agree with you. I think as well, if you want to tell a story, you have to have an ending. It's a defining, you know, fact.
Absolutely.
Do you think though that will mean that like the next Bond, they'll just get rid of everybody and just start anew? I mean, I think that would be the braver thing to do. Just get rid of Ralph Fiennes and all that sort of, the even the look, and just make a film which is much more, which is just has a total different flavor to it, you know?
I think they will. And the historical precedent is that when they really like some of these overflowing characters, like they did with Judi Dench, which I completely get, they carried Judi Dench over to Casino Royale, even though they're essentially two different continuities. And there was no sense that Judi Dench's M was any different to the M in the Brosnan movies, even though they were different Bonds at different points. But I think at this time, the Daniel Craig films have changed the way they make Bond. And I think they understand that audiences maybe are going to want a narrative this time. And I think they will make a Bond narrative with a view. And there've been rumors they've been trying to do this for the last few films, but I think they might have a plan in place this time a little bit more, and they might start thinking in terms of a real arc for Bond. Yeah. And that might mean we start with, as great as I think Ralph Fiennes is as M, and as much as I'd quite like to see Ben Whishaw come back and him and Naomi Harris, because I think they're a really good assortment of actors, I think they might start from the beginning and build something quite different this time. And they might not even do the conventional style that we've had, because I think they're aware they're going to keep this relevant, they're going to need to do what they did with Casino Royale, but they can't repeat Casino Royale. Yeah. And I think that'll be fascinating to see what they do.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that there's going to be, because Casino Royale was on the back of sort of the Bourne films as well, and was the sort of feeling that a certain sort of, as I say, sort of flavor, certain style. And I wonder nowadays, they, you know, who is their major competitor is going to be Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, Mission Impossible isn't going to go on forever. You know, it's going to go to space and then it's going to, then it's done.
Going to the multiverse, probably, knowing Tom Cruise.
Well, yeah, then they'll fire him into a volcano or something. I don't know. I'm kind of excited, and I kind of hope they choose a younger guy. I know that Bond is traditionally, you know, in his 30s, but I think they could sort of, that would be another way of sort of marking it out, of having like the youngest Bond yet, sort of, and that way also sort of sign somebody up to do, you know, 5 pictures, so they do have that. And with our experience of the Avengers and with Marvel Universe and everything, it seems that audiences are quite happy to come back and watch, or Harry Potter even, you know, come back and watch a 5 or 6 or 7 film series. TV is cinema. Cinema is TV. What can we say? Listen, Tony.
It's true.
Feel the stag. just popping them in randomly now.
You got to do it. Why not?
Absolutely no respect. No. Listen, thanks so much for talking to me. It's been a real pleasure. I really enjoyed your book. It was so timely as well, after his passing, that I got this opportunity to sort of read through it and sort of appreciate the complex character and fascinating character who, as you say, is very of his time. So cheers for that, Tony. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure. I really love this podcast, so it's a real delight to be on it. So I'm really grateful. And yeah, I thank you so much for your praise about the book. I do hope people enjoy it. It was so much fun to go through his filmography and discover him in different ways than I knew, actually, because there were things I'd never seen before and things I didn't know about him. So it was a journey for me as well. And I think if people enjoy it, then fantastic. And like I say, at the end of the book, I hope if he is on the golf course up there and he does catch it, I hope he enjoys it. That's all I can say.
Well, that sounds like an asshole.
Yeah, that's probably what he'd say, actually. Yeah, it's true.
Brilliant.
Johnny Black, what an asshole.
Yeah. Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
So that was my conversation with Tony Black. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we obviously did, especially our Sean Connery impersonations, which I think you will agree were like having Mr. Connery in the room. All that is left for me to do is thank Elliot Atkins for the music, Ali Harwood for the art, and thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, take care. Good at those.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.